This is VOA News. Via remote, I'm Marissa Melton. The United Nations overwhelmingly passed a draft resolution Thursday calling out the deteriorating situation in Afghanistan and setting the stage for increased aid. The action came the same day the Taliban government announced women will not be able to work out in gyms outside the home. It's the latest addition to an ever-increasing list of restrictions on women. Saba Qureshi, the president of the United Nations General Assembly, told the assembly that Afghanistan is in crisis.
Afghanistan is now the only state in the world that would deny girls their full rights to education. The cost of girls' education has been left to uncertainty amid seemingly random edicts from the Taliban.
Qureshi also noted the hunger plaguing much of the country's population and the disastrous state of its economy. The Taliban government does not have a representative at the UN because it is not recognized by the world body as legitimate. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky said Thursday that Ukrainian forces have liberated 41 settlements as they advance through the south of the country. And Ukraine's army chief said officials have yet to confirm whether Russia is indeed pulling out of Kherson as it said it would. But he said Ukrainian troops had advanced 7 kilometers in the past 24 hours. Ukraine's deputy defense minister, Hanna Malyar, wrote on Telegram Thursday that Russian troops were destroying communications infrastructure and looting museums as they made the retreat from the city of Kherson. The website IMI said troops had blown up part of a television broadcasting center. More on that at our website, voanews.com. This is VOA News. Wall Street stocks surged on Thursday and ended with steep gains, including a nearly 1,200-point jump for the Dow, as investors seized on data showing U.S. inflation slowing to spark a rally. The Dow Jones Industrial Average jumped 3.7%, while the broad-based S&P 500 jumped 5.5%. The tech-rich NASDAQ Composite Index was the big winner, soaring a whopping 7.4%. The gains came after a closely watched government data report showed annual consumer price inflation easing to 7.7% in October. That's the lowest since January. A report has found that tweets with racial slurs have soared since Elon Musk took over Twitter. AP correspondent Norman Hall has the story.
According to a digital civil rights group, instances of racial slurs have spiked on Twitter since Elon Musk purchased the influential platform, despite assurances that it had reduced hateful activity. Researchers at the Center for Countering Digital Hate found the number of tweets containing one of several different racial slurs climbed in the week after Musk bought Twitter. A racial epithet used to attack black people was found more than 26,000 times, three times the average for 2022. Slurs and offensive terms for trans people, homosexual men, Jews, and Hispanics also increased. Twitter said this week that it was making significant progress in bringing the numbers down. I'm Norman Hall.
Russia's President Vladimir Putin will not attend the G20 summit in Indonesia. VOA's Diane Roberts has more.
The news that Putin would not attend the G20 meeting was announced by an Indonesian government official. The move would enable the Russian leader to avoid a possible clash with the United States and its allies over the war in Ukraine. The summit would have been the first time U.S. President Joe Biden and Russian President Vladimir Putin were together at a gathering since the start of the Russian war in Ukraine. The event will take place on the Indonesian island of Bali and will start on November the 15th. Diane Roberts, VOA News.
Brazilian President-elect Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva blasted outgoing President Jair Bolsonaro on Thursday for involving the armed forces in auditing the country's electronic voting system. Bolsonaro says without proof that the current system is vulnerable to fraud. Conspiracy theorist Alex Jones and his company have been ordered to pay an extra $473 million to families and an FBI agent for calling the 2012 Sandy Hook school shooting a hoax. That brings the final judgment against him to a staggering $1.44 billion. More on that and all the stories we're covering at our website, voanews.com. Via remote, I'm Marissa Melton, VOA News.
Thank you. Today is Friday, November 11th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I am Chinedofo in Washington. Coming up in the next half hour, the U.S. sends additional air defenses to Ukraine, including a highly mobile Avenger missile system.
This increased air defense will be critical for Ukraine as Russia continues to use cruise missiles and Iranian-made drones to attack critical civilian infrastructure.
The balance of power in the U.S. Congress is still undecided as vote counting continues in many close races.
If they win the majority, it will be a narrow majority. It will be a quite narrow majority. And that will have implications for Kevin McCarthy and the entire Republican conference.
And a Glasgow music venue is harvesting heat from dancers and storing it in rocks. We'll have these stories and more next on International Edition. Stay tuned. Ukraine President Volodymyr Zelensky said on Thursday his forces have liberated 41 settlements as they advance through the south of the country. He said that the focus for liberated areas will be demining and making them safe for people to return. This as Washington announced an additional $400 million in military aid to Ukraine amid concerns financial assistance for the war against Russia could decline if Republicans take control of the Congress. White House National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan said the latest aid package will give Ukraine some badly needed air defense capability. The aid package will contain large amounts of ammunition and, for the first time, highly mobile Avenger air defense system. The U.S. has committed more than $18 billion in weapons and other equipment to Ukraine since Russia attacked in February.
This increased air defense will be critical for Ukraine as Russia continues to use cruise missiles and Iranian-made drones to attack critical civilian infrastructure.
That's White House National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan. The balance of power in the U.S. Congress for the next 2 years is still unknown after this week's midterm elections, with ballot counting continuing in many close races. Nobody's saying that Tuesday was a terrific night for former President Donald Trump. Many of the candidates he backed did not win, including U.S. Senate candidate celebrity TV doctor Mehmet Oz in Pennsylvania. Washington Post correspondent and reporter Dan Bowles tells VOA's Carol Van Dam it's clear the GOP is no longer in lockstep behind Trump.
More broadly, I think, setting aside the candidates he endorsed who had trouble, I think that the notion that in one way or another, Donald Trump is a radicalizing force within the Democratic electorate. And by radicalizing, what I mean is he energizes the opposition in ways that no other person in the Republican Party does. And what we saw on Tuesday was in some ways the same things we saw in 2018 and 2020, which was a coalition of people opposed to Trump who were determined to make their voices heard. And that was enough to offset to some degree, and in some ways to some significant degree, all of the other factors that were pushing in the Republican direction. And it's one of the big reasons Republicans are coming out of this election disappointed with the gains that they're making.
Your paper, The Washington Post, is reporting that Republican Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell and Senator Rick Scott ran separate political operations that were sometimes at odds with one another. How much do you think that political infighting mattered compared to other things, like these first-time candidates that were running with little to no political experience?
I think those can affect elections at the margins, but I think those are in some ways more interesting to political insiders than they are to real voters. I don't know that there is a huge practical effect of that other than to indicate how divided this Republican Party is. I mean, the relationship between Senator McConnell and Senator Scott has not been good, and it got very bad when Senator Scott put out his own agenda for what the Republican agenda ought to be. It was an agenda that McConnell quickly tried to distance himself from. But again, you know, midterm elections are what we normally think of as a referendum on the incumbent president. And this certainly was, but it was not that alone in ways that some past midterm elections have been. And so as a result of that, it was more of a choice. And there were a lot of people who did not like the idea of a big Republican majority coming in to take over in the House and the Senate.
So looking more broadly then at the picture now, where do things stand in the count for who will have majority power in the U.S. House of Representatives and Senate? And how critical is that to President Biden's ability to get his agenda through Congress these next 2 years?
Well, it looks like the Republicans are still on track to win the majority, but it's taking much, much longer than they ever thought it would. Kevin McCarthy, the person who would be speaker if the Republicans control the House, had plans to come out relatively early on Tuesday night to claim victory. And to the degree he had anything to say that night, it was when you wake up tomorrow, which is to say when you wake up Wednesday, we will be in the majority. And that passed without coming to truth. If they win the majority, it will be a narrow majority. It will be a quite narrow majority. And that will have implications for Kevin McCarthy and the entire Republican conference as to how they try to govern. You know, Nancy Pelosi learned that having a very slim majority in the House over the last 2 years makes the speaker's job very difficult. And Kevin McCarthy is going to find the same thing. This will be a divided Republican conference in the House. You know, he's going to have to try to maneuver through that.
That's Washington Post columnist and reporter Dan Bowles speaking with my colleague Carol Van Damme from Cambridge, Massachusetts. France has resolved a days-long spat with Italy's right-wing government by agreeing to take in a ship carrying more than 200 migrants rescued in the Mediterranean Sea. The Ocean Viking is due to dock in the southern French port of Toulon on Friday, but relations with Rome remains bitter. Lisa Bryant reports from Paris that the spat underscores Europe's unresolved dilemma of how to jointly handle asylum seekers, including those from Ukraine.
For the 234 migrants aboard Ocean Viking, France's agreement to take them in was the end of a long odyssey. They hail from a mix of countries, including Bangladesh, Syria, and Eritrea. And they count among hundreds rescued from the Mediterranean in late October by NGO SOS Méditerranée and the Red Cross. Italian officials finally allowed three boatloads to disembark, but not the Ocean Viking. French Interior Minister Gérald Darmanin called Rome's behavior unacceptable and warned there would be strong consequences in bilateral relations. France and Germany are expected to each welcome one-third of those on board. The rest will reportedly be shared among other European Union member states. Questions over fairly sharing asylum seekers, many arriving in Europe via the Mediterranean, aren't new. For years, frontline countries like Italy and Greece have demanded that other EU members take in more. But tensions have sharpened since Prime Minister Giorgia Meloni came to power in Italy. In France, the main opposition, the anti-immigrant far-right National Rally Party, also opposed letting Ocean Vikings migrants ashore. It would make France a suction cup for immigration, said party president Jordan Bardella. It would be unending. The several hundred thousand non-European asylum seekers who have arrived in the EU this year dwarf the more than million who surged into the bloc in 2015. But that number doesn't include the more than 4 million Ukrainian refugees who have been granted automatic asylum in the EU. Reports suggest migrant shelters in places such as Brussels, the EU's de facto capital, are packed, with Ukrainians getting priority. Lorena Martini, who specializes in migration at the European Council on Foreign Relations think tank, says the Ukraine crisis should galvanize more European solidarity toward asylum seekers from elsewhere. Some countries that once shunned migrants, like Poland, are now taking a major share of Ukrainian refugees.
From the point of view of government solidarity towards refugees from Ukraine and towards refugees from other parts of the world is something that is really due, especially if we're talking about European countries whose values of solidarity should be at the very base.
Some fear Europe's welcome mat for Ukrainians might disappear as well as winter sets in, possibly driving a new refugee influx westward. Lisa Bryant for VOA News, Paris.
Thank you, Lisa. And despite being classified as a developing country, China, as the world's largest greenhouse gas emitter, is facing pressure from developing countries to pay into a climate loss and damage fund. Charmaine Lee reports from Berlin.
Developing nations have, for the first time, asked China to pay for climate loss and damage, but China has refused to do so. At the COP27 UN Climate Change Conference in Egypt, small island nations said China and India are big polluters and should compensate for climate change's consequences for poor countries. Developing countries have, for years, urged richer economies to deliver on promises to compensate poor countries for the harm caused by human-caused climate change. That promise was providing $100 billion a year to developing countries for climate adaptation and mitigation. Now, a United Nations report says that amount should go up to $2.4 trillion per year to developing nations, excluding China. China has long been categorized as a developing nation, although it is the world's second largest economy. Beijing's stance in climate finance has not changed. The Chinese delegates still vowed solidarity with developing countries to push wealthier economies to deliver on their promises. In terms of climate responsibility, the United States and European Union countries combined have emitted close to half cumulative carbon emissions since the start of the Industrial Revolution. But now, China has been put on spot. Scott Moore, Director of China Programs and Strategic Initiatives at the University of Pennsylvania, specializing in environmental sustainability and international relations, discussed the change in perspective about China during COP27.
Its emissions growth, really just in the last 20, 25 years, has been so enormous that its emissions are kind of starting to veer into a territory where you can argue that China is actually responsible for a significant share of cumulative emissions.
To respond to island nations' call, China said it supports the mechanism of loss and damage compensation, but will not chip in. Moore said if China were to commit to pay for loss and damage, it would face pressure to act.
Combined with China's efforts to portray itself as a global leader on climate change, it would be very difficult for China to go back on any commitments it makes in loss and damage without endangering that image it's tried so hard to cultivate.
In recent years, China has become a donor country. In 2015, it set up a South-South Cooperation Climate Fund of over $3 billion to help developing nations to adapt to and mitigate climate change impacts. Beijing added another $1 billion to it earlier this year. Gerrit Merethet Hagelund, research professor at Fridtjof Nansen Institute in Oslo, focusing on China's climate change policies, said in an interview that China is aware of its responsibility.
It wants to be a responsible nation and sees that it has some responsibility to aid other, you know, poorer countries. China is developing its role in that direction.
She warned, however, that facing a severe heat wave and droughts this year, China will likely focus more on domestic mitigation and adaptation.
This year, we have seen floods and droughts with great economic impact. For instance, in China, a historic drought along the Yangtze River had severe impacts on water levels in Sichuan province, which greatly affected the hydropower production that was cut by 50% as a result.
Experts say that China is expected to face further pressure from both developed and developing nations in future climate negotiations. Sherming Li for VOA News, Berlin.
In other news, soccer fans from Israel and the Palestinian territories will be able to share flights to the World Cup in Qatar in a breakthrough agreement announced by FIFA. The organization says charter flights to Doha from Ben Gurion Airport near Tel Aviv for soccer games starting on November 20 will be open to all Palestinians. This includes residents from the occupied West Bank and blockaded Gaza Strip, which typically cannot travel through Israel's main airport. Though Israel and Qatar do not share diplomatic relations, a temporary consular service will be set up in Doha for the tournament. You're listening to VOA's International Edition. I am Chinedu Ofor in Washington. A United Nations report finds that opium cultivation in Afghanistan increased 32% over the previous year, despite a Taliban ban on cultivation of all narcotics in April. For Voice of America, Ibrahim Ahmad has this report from Kabul, narrated by Anne Ball.
Opium cultivation in Afghanistan has jumped 32% over the previous year, according to a new report by the United Nations Office on Drugs and Crime. Despite a ban in April on the cultivation of all narcotics, opium production surged from 177,000 to 233,000 hectares since the Taliban took over the country, making the 2022 crop the third largest area under cultivation since 1994, when systematic monitoring began. A huge jump, even though the UN reported that opium production was down 10% from 2021 because of the drought. The Taliban's Interior Ministry rejected the report. The Taliban says they have succeeded in outlawing the substance, but according to the UN, opium farmers' income increased from $425 million in 2021 to a record $1.4 billion in 2022. Kabul residents welcome the UN study and want restrictions on drug use and trafficking. Locals also say that poppy cultivation has led to an increase in drug addiction in the country. At a gathering in March, the Taliban's Deputy Prime Minister, Abdul Salam Hanafi, admitted there could be as many as 5 million drug users in Afghanistan. And while that number exceeds 2015 estimates by 1.5 million or more, treatment resources are down due to cuts in international funding since the Taliban assumed power. Drug treatment facilities and therapies have been cut in half. For Mohammed Ibrahim Momand in Kabul, Afghanistan, Ann Ball, VOA News.
A hot, sweaty dance floor is helping heat and cool a Glasgow music venue by harvesting the heat from dancers and storing it in rocks underground. Francisca Lanago of Reuters reports.
Imagine how much heat these sweaty nightclub goers are producing. What if, instead of being wasted, that energy could be harnessed, stored and used later to heat or cool other rooms? This venue in Scotland has been doing just that, through the use of an innovative system called body heat. Andrew Fleming Brown is the managing director of the venue SWG3.
Body heat, in essence, is our audience generating heat, which rises and it goes a long way in a room like this, and is then captured in these cassettes above us and literally piped back through a plant room into boreholes in the ground, which are out in our community garden.
Fleming Brown estimates that someone dancing their hardest can give off about 500 watts of power, compared to around 150 watts if you're just sitting on the couch. Capturing energy from gig attendees has allowed his venue's gas boiler to completely retire, saving money and cutting their energy use. Geothermal geologist David Walls helped Town Rock Energy develop the system.
That heat that's transferred from the nightclub then gets transported out to here, which is the community garden, and we've got 12 boreholes beneath the ground. The heat gets transferred into the rocks, which these boreholes access, and that's used to store the heat. Then when we need the heating for something else, at a different time of day or a different part of the venue, we can transfer the heat from the rocks back into the venue.
Previous attempts to make music venues more eco-friendly include dance floors that generate electricity and pedal-powered concerts. But according to Fleming Brown, none have offered the industry such a realistic way of lowering its emissions as body heat.
It potentially is a huge solution for the industry or the venues across the industry. I think the Coldplay is a great example of artists taking the lead, and we're starting to see that a lot with artists coming to the venue, where they start to inquire a little bit about the environmental credentials of venues. So if artists are making those initial inquiries and starting to kind of put their name towards sustainability, their fans and our audience will follow. So just by coming to an event, coming to a gig or a club or anything, you're part of that kind of low carbon solution.
This is Science in a Minute. A new study led by researchers at the University of Arizona found that tropical storms and hurricanes can act as natural heat pumps by feeding extreme heat into areas that were affected by the storms. According to a university press release, 3 days after Hurricane Fiona hit Puerto Rico on September 18th, the National Weather Service issued an extreme heat advisory. The advisory warned that the heat index, a combination of humidity and temperature, could reach the equivalent of up to 43 degrees Celsius. The researchers studied 53 tropical cyclones that affected the eastern Caribbean area between 1991 and 2020. The study shows that the heat index values in 14 Caribbean cities were always warmer than normal after the storm. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of Encounter. Next up, the results and implications of the U.S. midterm elections. Political gurus John Fortier and Jim Kessler discuss the winners and losers of congressional, state, and local elections and what it all means for the future of democracy and the rule of law in America, as well as for the remainder of President Biden's first term in office, dissecting the U.S. midterm elections. That's Encounter this Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.
This has been International Edition on The Voice of America. On behalf of the entire production team, thank you so much for listening. Visit our website for in-depth coverage of world events and news 24 hours at voanews.com. And check out voaafrica.com for more English language programming. You can find International Edition and our current affairs programs, Encounter, Press Conference USA, and Issues in the News on voanews.com. Until next time, I'm Chinedu from Washington. Have a great weekend.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States has demonstrated its commitment to countering systemic corruption and the Russian government's malign influence campaigns in Moldova by imposing sanctions on 9 individuals and 12 entities. The sanctioned individuals and entities include oligarchs widely recognized for capturing and corrupting Moldova's political and economic institutions, and those acting as Russian instruments seeking to manipulate the United States and its allies and partners, including Moldova and Ukraine. These sanctions expose not only Russia's covert strategy in Moldova, but also demonstrate how corruption undermines the rule of law, said Undersecretary of the Treasury for Terrorism and Financial Intelligence Brian Nelson. The Treasury Department's Office of Foreign Assets Control, or OFAC, designated Vladimir Plahotniuk, a former government official involved in corruption. Plahotniuk's bribery of law enforcement officials reflected his long-standing efforts to capture and corrupt Moldova's judicial and law enforcement institutions, while using his wealth and political influence to undermine political rivals and rule of law in the country. The State Department imposed visa restrictions on Plahotniuk in January 2020 for his involvement in significant corruption. As part of that action, Plahotniuk and his immediate family members are generally ineligible for entry to the United States. OFAC also designated Ilan Shor, leader of the Shor Party, for being responsible for directly or indirectly engaging in interference in a foreign government election for the benefit of the Russian government. A beneficiary of a large-scale 2014 money laundering scheme related to the theft of $1 billion from Moldovan banks, Shor has worked with other corrupt oligarchs and Moscow-based entities to create political unrest in Moldova and sought to undermine Moldova's bid for EU membership. OFAC designated 7 additional individuals and 12 entities that have been involved in the Kremlin's attempts to interfere in Moldova's elections. Russia has sought to advance its own interests by providing illicit financing, including funds earmarked for bribes and electoral fraud, to support pro-Kremlin political activity in Moldova. According to Undersecretary Nelson, Russian influence operations attempt to exploit weaknesses in target countries in order to destabilize them from within. These designations reaffirm the U.S. commitment to tackling corruption as a first-order national security threat and to promoting accountability for malign actors who seek to undermine Moldova's democratic institutions and elections. The United States will continue to impose costs on those threatening democracy abroad.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.